I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guests are Alice Waters and Ruth Reichel, two icons of American food history, culture, and writing. And now, join me on stage at the JCCSF as I introduce Alice Waters and Ruth Reichel. Tonight we are all so lucky because we get to listen into a conversation between two icons of American food history, culture, and writing who also happen to be dear friends. Alice Waters, legendary Chez Panisse restaurateur and slow food and edible schoolyard icon, and Ruth Reichel, one of our greatest living food writers, first met in Berkeley in the early 70s when Ruth was co-owner and cook at the Swallow restaurant, and Alice was, of course, beginning to change the world at Chez Panisse. They are here to celebrate Alice's new memoir, Coming to My Senses, which traces the circuitous road and tumultuous times leading to the opening of the restaurant and is really a wonderful, wonderful read. Alice Waters' belief that cooking should be based on the finest and freshest seasonal ingredients produced sustainably and locally has changed how America eats, shops, educates our children, and thinks. Since 1971, her restaurant Chez Panisse has created a community of local farmers and ranchers and a food economy that is good, clean, and fair. Her edible schoolyard project has created a sea change in how school children learn and are fed in this country, and she is a tireless activist and advocate for school lunch reform. Awarded the National Humanities Medal by President Obama in 2015, she's the author of many wonderful books, including her new memoir, which we're here to celebrate tonight. Ruth Reichel began writing about food in 1972 and the next year moved to Berkeley and became co-owner and cook at the Swallow Restaurant. She was a restaurant critic for New West and California magazines, went on to be the restaurant critic and food editor of the Los Angeles Times, and then served as restaurant critic for the New York Times. In 1999, she joined Gourmet Magazine, where she was editor-in-chief for 10 years. The author of four memoirs, including Tender at the Bone and Comfort Me with Apples, a novel, a cookbook, and more. She's also at work on a memoir of her gourmet years, as well as another novel. So please join me to welcome Alice Waters and Ruth Reichel.
Okay, I flew in this morning and reread Alice's wonderful memoir because I read it probably a year ago in Galley and I wanted to remember what it was like. And one of the things that it did was bring back to me the Berkeley that we used to live in. And it is a remarkably frank book. And one of the things I want to ask you is, like, why did you write this book?
I was obliged to write it. It was part of a contract that I had with the publisher. And so I had to think of a way to do it that helped me remember what had happened to me. And I knew that it couldn't be about the early days of the restaurant. I knew that it had to come before that because I've really written about, and I think everybody knows about the early days of the restaurant through the 40th birthday book. And I just decided that it would be from birth to the opening of Chez Panisse. And then I had this idea that I always think of the title first of the book. And so when I
never do that.
You don't?
Never. It takes me forever to come up with a title.
No, that really defines what the book is about for me. And then I go backwards. So when I thought of Coming to My Senses, I really thought that's what happened to me in my life. I just kind of woke up in a way. And then I thought the subtitle should be The Making of a Counterculture Cook, because I wanted it to appeal to young people who are part of that counterculture right now. And I never imagined, though, that it would be so important that I didn't make the deadline a year earlier. Now the idea of a counterculture is real. And so I think it coming out in September of this last year was kind of perfect timing. And I've been able to really talk about how empowered I was by what was going on in Berkeley in the 60s and stopping the war in Vietnam and learning how to cook.
I think we should talk a little bit about what it was like in Berkeley. I mean, I didn't get there until the early 70s, so I wasn't there in the 60s. But I feel really sorry for kids today that they don't have that opportunity to... I mean, we all lived on nothing, and you could live on nothing. And we all decided that we were going to follow our passions and do what we cared about. And I don't think kids today get to do that because there is no place that... I mean, I was probably living more extremely in more poverty than you were. I mean, I was living in a commune where my rent was $45 a month. My husband and I lived on $3,000 a year for 10 years in Berkeley, for the two of us. But it meant that we had enormous freedom. And it meant that you could open a restaurant like Chez Panisse. And, you know, one of the things that's so wonderful about this book is that you see someone opening a restaurant with no business idea at all.
Well, that was kind of the beauty of it, in a way. You know, if I had really thought about it as a business, I would have been betraying the values that we held so dear. The idea of making money was just not what it was about. And it never even occurred to me that it wouldn't be successful if it were really tasty. I was sure that it would work. And I was sure that people would want to come because, again, there were people like you who just knew that you had to support your friends and you would go and eat there for that purpose.
One of the things that's so interesting to me is you talk about all the people who were working there in the early days, and you talk about Bob Wax. And when I first got to the Swallow, his parents funded my restaurant. They funded the Swallow, and one of the things in every meeting was, how much money are we going to pay back to the Waxes? And you talk about John Harris, who was in... So there was this sort of... The food community was really small. We all sort of knew each other, and we were all weird in a way. I mean, it's true that most people didn't care that much about food, and there was this small, passionate group in Berkeley who cared and who, you know, opened the cheese board and Pig by the Tail and the juice bar and...
Pete's Coffee.
And Pete's Coffee. And we were all convinced that this was really important. I think a big part of it that is very hard for people to understand today is that we had stopped the war in Vietnam and we really felt powerful.
It's true.
And we looked around for, like, what's the next thing that we can do? And we looked at food. And suddenly, you know, one of the things I was studying was the vertical integration of agribusiness, and it really terrified me. And food seemed like honest work, right? I mean, you open a restaurant, it's you can feel proud of what you're doing. And growing your own food, I mean, we all had gardens in our backyards, and I mean, this is long before you were actually going out and thinking organically, or as you say in the book, provenance wasn't one of the things, I mean, it's probably all you think about today.
It is all I think about. Where did it come from?
But we weren't thinking about...
Well, in a way, we were in Berkeley. I had been to France, and I had tasted this food that I never had tasted before, and it was a real awakening for me. And so when I came back to Berkeley after that time, I wanted food that tasted like that. So I was in the search for that. But, you know, Diet for a Small Planet was published in the mid-60s, I think it was.
71, I think.
71?
Yeah.
But those ideas were around in the 60s and so.
Frankie LePay was really important to our generation.
Really,
I mean,
important.
I mean, in where I lived, I mean, the idea that we were feeding 22 pounds, I think, of usable protein to cattle to get one usable pound of protein seemed insane. And it was just this eye-opening revelation that, oh, if we ate differently, there would be enough food to feed the world. I mean, that was really powerful for
really important
all of
to
us.
Me too. And so I knew that those things were in, you know, they were in the back of my mind when Chez Benny's opened. And we were in a search for taste, and in that search for taste, we ended up at the doorsteps of the organic local farmers and ranchers.
But the other thing that this book makes really clear is that the difference between you and the rest of us mm-hmm. was that you had a really aesthetic approach to it. I mean, your writing on lighting in this book is amazing. Talk about lighting a little bit.
It's really, really important to me because I think you can make a room feel great with the simplest kind of lighting. I mean, lighting a candle at a dinner table can make the whole room just, and the way people look. And I just thought if I could light the restaurant in that way, that you could see the food and you could see each other in a beautiful way, that would be part of the restaurant's seduction, if you will. That it was like, for me, I was a Montessori teacher, and I always learned about preparing the classroom so that when the kids came in, that they would fall in love with learning. And so I was preparing Chez Panisse in that same way, and I wanted it to smell good. I was obsessed with, you know, I would burn rosemary in the restaurant to make it smell good, and I wanted it to be beautiful.
And you talk about clothing too. You talk about Jackie and and, you know, how people dress, and every time you introduce somebody, you know, Jerry Budrick comes in, you talk about his clothing, and the rest of us in Berkeley weren't thinking in an aesthetic way.
Well, you have to remember that I went to France. And it really changed my life. And there was kind of, I mean, this was when France was a slow food culture. I mean, kids came home for 2 hours to eat with their parents for lunch.
Alice, I went to French schools for 4 years.
You didn't notice any of
this? It did not have the same, I mean, it certainly affected how I thought about food, but it didn't change my whole aesthetic.
Well,
I mean, but
we didn't
go
to the same restaurants, I guess. But there was always a beautiful tablecloth and kind of that pale peach color, pink tablecloths, and real napkins.
I know, I was eating at Routier, you know. I mean, it was great food, but not so beautiful. And you talk about, like, what David, you know, his aesthetic sense and what it meant to you.
Well, David Goins really influenced me about a lot of things, but particularly about the way things were written, about signage, about typeface, about there was a particular way to design things so that they were really legible. And I learned calligraphy from him. And he was a very strict teacher.
But the thing is that you really were open to this. I mean, my father was a book designer. He designed the American edition of Ulysses. I grew up with typography. It never influenced me in any particular way. You were like a sponge for aesthetics. I mean, it's really in your nature. And I think it's, I mean, just the way you really want to find the perfect food for every single person. I mean, I've always been convinced that you think that if you can just find the single perfect flavor for every person, you will change their lives and they will understand what flavor is about. And you never stop trying.
That's true.
Flavor is important for you, but the whole package. And I think that's a very big part of what the success of Chez Panisse has been down the years. I mean, I think, you know, people talk about how you went out and, you know, found organic food and encouraged farmers, and that's important, but you also created a really beautiful environment for people, for both the people who worked there. I mean, you made a family there that continues to this day. And you wanted beauty in more than just flavor, and you wanted it in every way.
I wanted it in my own life. In my own everyday life, I think about when we rebuilt the restaurant after the fire, and we had burned down the wall between the dining room and the kitchen, and I guess I always wanted that wall down, and maybe I was part of starting the fire. I was on the grill that night. I'm not sure, but I always wanted, I felt sort of punished being in the kitchen and cooking and not being able to see the people that were eating the food in the dining room and not being able to see the sunset out the front windows of the restaurant. That why should the people in the kitchen not have that beautiful Vermeer light coming in? And why shouldn't the customers be allowed to really see how their food was being prepared? But it was always, you know, I was always thinking about what I wanted sort of for myself if I were a cook in the kitchen. Or we made a table for people to sit around for their staff meal because I wanted to eat that way. I had remembered that when I was in France, the before the lunch, and you could walk into a restaurant, and there was a table all set for the staff. Surely you saw that.
Oh, yeah.
And the cooks all eating, and they ate together, and then they began the service. And so a lot of it, Carrie Glenn, who does the flowers for the restaurant, she would go forage to find just what was alive and beautiful in Berkeley at that moment. And so I, you know, we were always cooking all day and all night. We weren't out, you know, in nature. And she brought nature into the restaurant. And so it reinforced what we were cooking, to have an enormous branch of quince, like right now in the restaurant. And we're making things of spring right now. And it's such a delight for me to be in that environment.
You're listening to restaurateur Alice Waters of Chez Panisse, whose new memoir is Coming to My Senses, The Making of a Counterculture Cook, and food writer Ruth Reichel on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Okay, I want to talk about something that I don't think you and I have discussed since those days, but do you remember when you decided we should start a cooking school?
No.
No, we had all these meetings with Jim Nasikas and Marion Cunningham and Cecilia, and you and me. This is about early 80s, and you had this notion of starting a cooking school that would begin in the garden. And that, do you not remember this at all?
You know, I do remember. I didn't realize that Jim Nasikas and Marion were there, but I had a friend of mine sent me a whole description of my idea for a cooking school where people would work in the garden for the first 6 months before they ever came into the kitchen. Is that part of that? Then they would look at the ingredients, and then ultimately they were beginning to prepare. But I still think that's a great way to begin.
I mean, so we had these very earnest meetings in Jack London Square, and we would meet like once a month, and I mean, it was kind of serious, and it never went anywhere. But it kind of amazes me that that still doesn't exist.
It's true.
I mean, why doesn't it exist? I mean, isn't this what we need to really, you know, I mean, as you once said to me, your ideal restaurant would be you would give people a bottle of olive oil, really good olive oil and really good vinegar, and you would lead them into a beautiful garden full of lettuces, and you would say, there it is, help yourself.
Maybe a little salt, too. But I think you probably know about Ballymaloe Cooking School in Ireland. But that comes closest to the vision that I have about learning to cook. And they have a huge garden, and they make cheese there, they have chickens, and the whole nine yards, and they people who come really have that experience of with the animals.
But don't you think if we could convince the CIA in Hyde Park that this would be a great curriculum, it would change? I mean, because they are turning out the people who are feeding middle America, really.
I have suggested it.
So how did you come to the idea of the edible schoolyards?
Well, Fanny was born, my daughter. And I started to think about what her future would be. And I wondered where she would go to school. And I was really, that was on my mind. What are we teaching our children? And then every day I went past the Martin Luther King Junior Middle School in Berkeley on my way to Chez Panisse. And the school looked abandoned, with graffiti on the walls, and looked completely untended. And so I remarked on that in an interview, And the principal of the school called me into his office. And Mr. Smith, that was Neil Smith, and that was 23 years ago. And I think he thought I could help plant a garden. And we took a walk around the school, and right then and there, I kind of had the whole vision, which, again, I think that way, the big way, and then I work back to how it can happen. But I saw this big piece of land. It was built on 17 acres in 1921 for 500 children, 6th, 7th, and 8th graders. And now there are 1,000 kids, and they speak at home 22 different languages. It's English as a second language class, and I mean population that comes from all around Berkeley. And this piece of property had been completely neglected in the back. And so I pointed out, oh, Neil, a garden there. You could have classes where you could teach math and science in the garden. And then I said, well, we have to build a kitchen classroom too. And they could learn a language, cooking in the kitchen or math or history. And I was going on, and I looked out to this blacktop and I said, well, we could build a cafeteria. We'll call it for the Center for the Studies of Gastronomic Sciences. And he said, oh, my God. where, of course, I was going to give everybody a free school lunch. And they would eat together at the table. And they would be given credit for eating it. And I didn't hear from him. But 6 months later, he called me back. And he said, okay, Alice. I said, it's either all or nothing, Neil.
That does tend to be your way.
It's either all or nothing. Cafeteria, classrooms, integrated this, free school lunch. He said, Alice, I really believe in the vision. And we will do that. But let's just talk about a garden. It'll be our little secret, free school lunch. And so here we are. And it's amazing what has come to pass, because it was an idea that was so beautifully realized by these incredible teachers, that Esther Cook being one of the first ones, and she's still there. And every day they breathe life into this idea. And it's not about cooking or gardening, per se. It's about a better way to learn math or science, the academic subjects. And they really learn them. I say, you know, that any of those kids could give a TED Talk after 3 years in the Edible Schoolyard. I mean, they're just falling in love with nature, and they're falling in love with learning. And it's a beautiful thing. It's almost as if they've been deprived. Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about where we are now. I did a panel a few months ago with Sam Cass, who, if you don't know, was the person in the Obama White House who came in to feed the family and then helped Obama and helped Michelle with the Let's Move movement and the garden and all of that. And he was really angry. I mean, he said, you know, it's going to be a long time. We had somebody in the White House for 8 years who really cared about food. And it's going to be a long time before we have anybody else who cares that much about food. And we did not build a movement. We did not hire lawyers, make policy, etc. And we blew it. And I feel like one of the few movements that keeps going. I mean, he's right. We didn't hire lawyers and make policy, as the environmental movement did. They were prepared when the Obamas got in there. But we're a smaller movement, a newer movement than the environmental movement. And we squandered that time. And I think the one place that we haven't is in school food. I mean, I think it's the one sort of hopeful sign on the horizon of what we can do with food, because that really seems to be moving forward. And talk a little bit about what your latest mission is.
Well, I've always, as I said, been part of the counterculture, and I'm not looking to the government to make the rules and implement them. I am the good rules. And I think we have to be the change we want to make. We have to do it. And we realized that when we were experimenting and trying to fit into that little minuscule budget of the school lunch reimbursement, that if we went directly to the organic farmers without any middleman and worked with them, that we could buy organic milk and chicken legs and various fruit and all kinds of things that the kids love, and gave the money directly to those farmers and proved that organic food isn't too expensive, one, and that we could have that interaction very successfully, as we've done with Chez Panisse for, 47 years. We buy directly. And at fast food culture would have us believe that it's too difficult. It is not.
Well, in 19, maybe 80, mm-hmm. 79, it was one of the first articles I ever wrote. I did a piece about school lunch in California. And I wrote about four different school programs. They all had exactly the same budget. The woman who ran the Oakland School Project thought that everybody who worked for her was an idiot, and that she had to make it as easy as possible, and she bought everything frozen, and all they had to do was, open up frozen packages and put it on plates. And so they were basically feeding their kids fast food. The woman who ran the school lunch program in Santa Cruz was way ahead of her time and was convinced that that additives were creating ADHD in the kids. And she went to farmers, and she had most of the people who worked for her were Mexican women. They were cooking everything from scratch with organic food. The kids loved the food. Then there was a woman in Roland Heights who set up a central commissary, and they cooked everything from scratch, not with organic, but they cooked everything from scratch in one central commissary and then sent it out to the various schools. It was fascinating to me because they all had exactly the same budgets and the same guidelines, and it was proof that you could do anything within those guidelines if you were creative.
Exactly. If you don't have the restrictions that are part of that pyramid. I mean, I almost don't want to take the money from the reimbursement, because there's so many papers you have to fill out. It is not the way I think about food. I'm always wanting to think about vegetables and whole grains and vegetable substitutes for protein. I mean, proteins of vegetables and grains. And I think that the foods around the world, which have always been considered nutritious, affordable, easy to grow, available. Those are the kinds of meals that I would imagine that we could serve. And if it were connected with the kids' studies, and they were studying the Silk Road in India, they might be eating the food of India. They might be eating a whole wheat papadum, or they might be eating the food of the Middle East, tabbouleh salad and hummus. And one thing that we have learned from the Edible Schoolyard Project, aside from if they grow it, they cook it, they all eat it, besides that, the one thing we've learned is they generally all like the very simple food that cultures globally have eaten, both for their nutrition and for taste.
Do you know about Dan Barber's new
project? Yes, I'm fascinated by it.
It's so great. So if you don't all know, Dan Barber is a chef in New York, and he believes that seeds are the real way to change America. And he has started a company just this week where they are growing. He has seed breeders breeding seeds for flavor.
And for nutrition. The two together.
And right now they have 5 different seeds that they're selling, but they're available to anyone. You can buy them. They aren't patenting them. They're totally organic. And it's fascinating because it turns out that one of the things that happens is that most of the organic seeds that you can buy today start with non-organic. I mean, they develop them. And these are, they're starting totally from scratch. It's all organic. And they're much more nutritious if they start from right from the beginning. And it's such an interesting idea.
Well, he came and spoke at an edible education course that we've been doing at Cal, which is streamed, and you can listen to all the people this has been happening over about 6 years at the university, and now it's in the Haas Business School. So Dan Barber came just 2 weeks ago, and he talked about this project. And of course, in this country, we've always been breeding seeds for shipability and for size, never for taste. If you can imagine this, not for taste or nutrition. And he talked about the squash, his honey nut squash. And he said, I never knew that it was important to pick the squash when it was ripe, because that's when it has the most nutrition. And so he developed with this breeder a squash that you could tell in the field when it was ripe. So it began green, and then it got more orange. And when you have a butternut squash out there in the field, you don't know whether it is ripe or not. And now you can tell with this new little squash, but so fascinating.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features restaurateur Alice Waters of Chez Panisse, whose new memoir is Coming to My Senses, The Making of a Counterculture Cook, and food writer Ruth Reichel. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
So I want to talk about, I don't know if you remember this, do you remember, I mean, this is also, I think, the late 70s. I knew that Alice was getting her produce from the Chino Ranch. And it was being sent up because you...
But there was nobody that was growing vegetables like those that I had tasted in France. And a French guy, friend of ours, sent me a box of haricots verts, and I just nearly cried. And I said, we have to buy these all the time for Chimney's. And so we had somebody who came up who was making deliveries of another kind every week, and he agreed to bring us boxes of produce then.
So I wanted to go do an article about Luchino's because I was fascinated. And I called them, and they said, well, we don't talk to the press. So I called Alice and said, you know, if you next time you go to Luchino Ranch, can I come with you? And she said yes, and we went down there, and we spent a weekend down there. What I remember so clearly is, first of all, everything we had there was, I mean, you have to remember, this is like the 70s when you couldn't get great produce if you were an ordinary person. And, you know, strawberries were these big, clunky things that had no flavor and no aroma and were white in the middle. And here we are eating corn that's so delicious. We're just standing in the fields eating corn raw. And Tom Chino did this, the Chino tomato test, where he would grow 30 tomatoes every year and make you taste through them all and say which you thought was the best. And the next year he would grow the one that everybody had decided was the best and 29 others, and he kept trying to look for perfect tomatoes. But right at the end of the time that we were there, we went out and picked strawberries for dinner at Chez Panisse. And the three of us got on the plane, each carrying a flat of strawberries. And it was a fairly small plane that flew from San Diego to Oakland. And the aroma of those berries filled the plane. And one by one, every single person on that plane got up and came over and begged for a berry. You know, and they all said, I forgot what strawberries smelled like. And I watched Alice giving away dessert at Chez Panisse with this huge smile on her face, because she was teaching these people about flavor. She was bringing back a flavor memory.
Well, I always believe that if Bill Clinton had just eaten a Suncrest peach at its perfect moment, that he would have had an epiphany.
And I think this is the moment when we should take questions.
Indeed.
Hi, thank you both for your writing, for your food, for everything you've done. I'm a kid who was raised on carob and lucky enough to have some access to good food, and your influence certainly helped. I'm curious about your thoughts about influencing sort of mass media around food. We have the Food Network and Bravo's Top Chef and all of that so many people consume, and have taken food while making it somewhat more accessible. Also, I think, turned it into these food wars and competitions, and I'm curious about your thoughts about how to better infiltrate and shape that thinking as well. Thank you.
Well, I just have to say that we do an Iron Chef at the Edible Schoolyard Project. And I've always wanted to do it this way on television, where they're not judged just on taste and presentation. They're judged on how well they work as a group to produce it, how well they clean up, how well... I want to have a show where the chefs are judged by the children, where they have to really be judged differently, and they're using
Well, yes. I have to say, I mean, I was a judge for a few seasons on Top Chef Masters, oh, yeah. And we did do an episode where the chefs were judged by children.
And how did that work out?
Well, it was kind of surprising, actually, because the one who won did something that was so counterintuitive that you thought every kid would hate, and in fact, the kids were much more adventurous than anybody thought that they would be in their tastes. Well, he did an eggplant Jell-O. But yeah. I mean, I have a lot of thoughts about this because, I really think that food culture in America changed dramatically with the advent of the TV Food Network, and that food television started out being really stupid, but it's kind of like the way we all learned to drink wine, starting with the Flying Nun and Matus, and then we went up. And I mean, if you look at what's happened to food television, I mean, it's gone from really, you know, stuff that just makes you cringe because it's so completely dumb, to stuff that's kind of wonderful now. I mean, there's more and better food television all the time, but because of food television, we have the smartest generation of eaters that this country has ever raised. And it wrenched food into popular culture in a way that I never could have imagined when I started writing about food.
But again, I just feel like if we have that vicarious experience of cooking on television, most people don't get beyond that and get really into the kitchen. I think we're doing this, we're eating kind of fast food in front of the television and watching this entertainment. I just remember Julia Child, and nothing has ever been like that for me since.
See, I think the stuff that's getting done now is so much better. I mean, well, like, you know,
But I'd like to know whether there's anybody who's really talking about the provenance of food.
I think there's deeply. Almost everything. I mean.
What programs are you thinking about?
Well, I mean, Mind of a Chef, the new David Chang's new Ugly Delicious. I mean,
he doesn't ever talk about the provenance of food. He's
I haven't watched the whole series. Have you watched it? It just came on. How did you watch it all?
Because everybody said, "Oh my God!" I wish you were using his celebrity to talk about that.
I mean, he's talking about politics and race and gender. I mean, he's talking about stuff that is.
He's
important.
Talking about Domino's Pizza.
No, I'm sorry.
He is
talking about the impact of immigration on American food in a way that is impactful and important, I think. And you know, and you look at some of the Chef's Tables things, and
I think there's
great food TV.
No, I love David Chang. I really like him very, very much, and I think that's incredibly important to talk about that, but not to the exclusion of or to give the impression that the food truck food is valuable and not really go to its source. Where does it come from? Where does it come from? Are we supporting a whole system that is, slavery for immigrants on the other end? I mean, we're talking about fast food nation. I mean, it's shocking what's going on in the corporations that are producing meat across the country.
But it's a big tent. There is lots of room for pieces about provenance, pieces about justice, social justice for food workers. I mean, the thing is that we are talking about all these things in a way we never have before, and you can't have everybody doing exactly the same thing. I mean, my particular concern is actually what's happening with farm workers, and there's not very much being done about that, but people are talking about it for the first time in the last couple of years. I mean, there was an American Crime, a whole series about what was happening to farm workers. And, I mean, I think that these things are coming into the culture in a way that they never have before. And I think, you know, to say that everybody should be doing the same thing is not the way to be looking at it.
But I think we have to all know about where our food comes from, Ruth, because we're either supporting a system that is building community and taking care of the land for the future, or we're not. And everybody's food decisions every day are terribly, terribly important. And I think taste and tradition and everything else comes after that and from that, from the good values of those farmers and the people who
take
care of their
farm. And that's important for you to talk about, but everybody doesn't have to talk about that. I mean, I think the Me Too movement is really important and should be talked about. And I think that gender issues are important and should be talked about. And, you know, people need to talk about the things that are most important to them. And everybody doesn't have to have the same conversation.
No, I do understand that. But don't you think that a lot of it comes from the food production place? I feel like at the beginning with the farmers that we dealt with, I was always telling them what to plant. And here they are now telling us what to eat and how to take care of their land by the choices that we make. And their values, the values of the way they take care of the people on the farm and the work that they do, the understanding of how hard it is. And that's all come into the restaurant and helped us humanize what we do. And so I'm not doing this to any kind of exclusion of these other conversations. I'm not. I think somehow it all goes back to how we're treating people in the production of what we all eat, and we have to eat every day to live.
I agree with that, but I also think, you know, when you look at a Chef's Table episode about Massimo Bottura, who is trying to feed poor people, that, I mean, he's not talking about provenance, he's talking about something else, and that's what's important to him. And I think, you know, we need all of these voices, because there are a lot of issues we all have to deal with. And, you know, when Dan does food waste, that's important. And, you know, the fact is that we are hearing about all these things in a way that we just didn't 5 years ago. I think we should take another question.
The next question is on your right.
Yes, thank you so much. I'm curious about the how you reconcile these concepts with regard to here in the Bay Area. I think one out of five or one out of four children are food insecure, and that there's families that are really struggling just to feed their family. So how do you think, I mean, it's hard to compete when you see like McDonald's can give you a whole meal for $3. How do you see us moving forward where we can really deal with this constant food insecurity and also enrich the food when people, I think, are feeling desperate and just want to eat what's cheap and available.
Yeah. No, I completely understand that, and it's the reason that I want to go to the public school system and begin a kindergarten and feed every single child breakfast, lunch, and an afternoon snack for free. For free. And that, I know, and I think probably, Ruth, would you'd agree with me, that learning how to cook is the most affordable way to eat and to feed children nutritious food. But we need to engage them in the cooking, too. And I've heard about a lot of projects where they bring the parents and the kids together and they learn to cook very simple, basic food. And I think once you put yourself in those circumstances, you want to go back again. You do. And of course, participating in any kind of community garden to grow your own food is, you know, a great reward. But we need to begin in our public school, which is, from my point of view, our last truly democratic institution in this country.
And the other thing is we really need to understand how much our tax policy affects what we eat. I mean, I think that we are a long way from understanding how dominated we are by tax policy on food. And there is a reason why going to McDonald's is cheap. It's not really cheap. It's cheap because we're subsidizing that food. And I mean, we have to do some real rethinking of many things. And one of them is that. And the other thing is there's a kind of craziness in how we eat in nuclear families. And if we could learn to cook communally in some way, it would make everybody's lives easier.
I've always thought that.
You know, if you know, people in a building designate, you know, one person cooked for five families, and if you were a mother, like a single mother with four children, if you pulled your money with other people in your building, and one of you cooked every night a week, and so you're really only cooking one night a week, but your kids are, it would be much cheaper, it would be easier. I mean, we really need to think of different ways of thinking about the ways that we feed ourselves. But of course, corporate America doesn't want us to do that because it's not profitable for them.
That's right.
Thank you.
But thank you.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guests were restaurateur Alice Waters of Chez Panisse and food writer Ruth Reichel. Waters' new memoir is Coming to My Senses, The Making of a Counterculture Cook. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Brandon Battaglia, Dan Folds, Alex Espalet, and Lincoln Andrews. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.